Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about carbon. Carbon is the most basic building material of life. Our civilization is built on a carbon foundation. Yet, if you read the news, carbon seems to be nothing but trouble, at least as far as it is involved in global climate change. Well, this morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with science and technology writer Eric Roston, and we'll talk about his book, The Carbon Age. The subtitle is How Life's Core Element Has Become Civilization's Greatest Threat. It's published by Walker. And it looks at the way that, among other things, looks at the way that two centuries of burning hydrocarbon minerals have disturbed Earth's natural carbon cycle. And there's much more in the book as well. Our guest Eric Roston covered technology, science, policy, and energy issues at Time magazine for 6 years, also contributed to Time's special issue about September 11th, which won a National Magazine Award in 2002. This is his first book. He makes his home in Washington, D.C., and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here where we are in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you're certainly welcome to call. And the only thing we ask of people who are calling in is just that people try to keep their comments brief just so that we can keep moving along. But anybody who is listening is certainly welcome to call. Mr. Roston, hello.
Hi. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. And yourself?
I'm doing great.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I think that given the concerns about global climate change and the role that carbon dioxide plays, it's certainly no surprise that someone might want to write a book about that. And in fact, people have written books about that. This book it certainly deals with that and deals with the carbon cycle, and that's something that we'll be talking about. But this has a broader kind of focus. There's so much in this book. You know, much more than we could talk about here that I think I could absorb in the short amount of time that I had to spend with it. What was it that got you interested in writing about carbon and trying to, I suppose one would argue, give a more full picture of carbon and its place in the environment of Earth?
This book is the book that I went into the store to buy a couple of years ago and couldn't because nobody had written it yet. And at the time, I was covering energy and climate for Time, and I read all the books that came out in the daily tick of articles and newspapers and magazines. And I was talking a lot about carbon, and other people were talking a lot about carbon, and I just felt that nobody really knew what it was. And so it was that's how it emerged. It was my feeling that, gosh, you know, I'm really up on energy and global warming, and there's a lot of wonderful material about it. But why doesn't anyone tell me what carbon is? And at the same time that was happening, you had Lance Armstrong racing to victory in Paris every year on a $6,500 carbon fiber bike. You had the Atkins diet telling everybody to drop their carbs, even though before a big race, Lance would eat all the carbs.
Yeah.
Carbon was good and bad and good and bad and good and bad. But since it's the central organizing principle of all life and civilization, I thought, wow, you know, isn't there just a grand narrative there that we could tell that'll help everything make more sense?
Without getting too deeply into chemistry and losing people, and including me, is it possible to talk about what it is about carbon that something no doubt about its structure and the way that it combines with other things that not only makes it the basis of life, but it ends up in so many other things.
Yeah, well, one of the just remarkable things to begin with is that, yeah, there's 92 naturally occurring elements. And just if you didn't know, anything, you might expect that an equal smattering of them makes up life. But really, only four of them make up the bulk of life, and carbon is the one that holds them together. I think about carbon as kind of atomic Velcro. And, you know, what does Velcro do? Well, it holds things together as long as we want them to hold together, and then it allows them to come apart when we want them to come apart. And that is fundamental to really understanding what carbon does, because in our DNA, it's holding, our DNA is 70 or 80% carbon, and it holds the other atoms of life into that beautiful double helix. And that's what we count on it for there as a structural material. But carbon, of course, also knows when to let go, and it lets go when the body processes carbohydrates into energy. It lets go in the internal combustion engine and releasing the energy of gasoline into the energy of motion. It lets go in TNT. And all of these things, in respiration, internal combustion, explosives, non-nuclear explosives, are all simple functions of carbon letting go.
People have, I think, at least imagined the possibility that other elements could take that place of carbon as a basis for life. Silicon, for example. Is it really so difficult to imagine that some other element could do what carbon does? Is it that unique?
It's that unique. It's absolutely that unique. And you think about what carbon dioxide is. It's the beginning of everything. It keeps the planet warm. It keeps retains the heat. It keeps the oceans from icing over. It's the first food. Plants take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and turn it into carbohydrates and proteins and all the other molecules of life. And then we come along and eat those. And carbon dioxide is the basic input into all of life. But then if you look at silicon dioxide, that's sand, and there's not a lot you can do with sand. So I always thought that was a good way to focus my mind on that question. And it's a 150-year-old question, but really all you need to do is look at just how much you can do with how much life does with carbon dioxide versus the just inert value of sand.
I think that it is the case that carbon, that humans have been aware of carbon as an element for a long time. It's one of the first that people actually thought about as being a basic building block in that way. How did people even realize that there was such a thing as carbon?
At one point in my research, one day I was in the library and thought, oh, you know what? I need to have an etymology of carbon in the book, of course. You know, it's a book all about carbon. I better say where the word comes from. And I couldn't find one because it's that old. There are traces to words that look similar to that in Roman Latin. But carbon, as long as we have had fire, we've known that black stuff left over is carbon. Until the early part of the 19th century, however, science didn't really organize itself. It wasn't until the 18-teens, for example, that a Swedish chemist first looked at these basic elements that they already knew about and decided to call carbon C.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, let me quickly reintroduce, is Eric Roston. He's the author of the book The Carbon Age, How Life's Core Element Has Become Civilization's Greatest Threat. That's the subtitle. It's published by Walker. He was a politics and business writer for Time magazine for 6 years. He also covered technology, international trade, climate, and energy issues. He's now a senior associate in the Washington, D.C. office of Duke University's Nicholas Institute for Environmental Policy Solutions. And he's joining us by phone. Again, questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And I believe that we have somebody who's getting ready to join us, and that's on our toll-free line. Let's go there. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Carbon, like you say, carbon is an extremely interesting chemical, not alone in our atmosphere, but also you realize that there's only one thing that dissolves carbon. And most people say, well, sure, it dissolves in water, but no, it's an ionic effect when it dissolves in water. It only dissolves in iron, and that compound becomes steel or cast iron, malleable iron, things that do a whole lot for our civilization. And then animals have an interesting thing to do with carbon dioxide that affects our lives every day, too, that you haven't mentioned, in that they take a lot of carbon dioxide out of water and turn it into calcium carbonate. And calcium carbonate is seashells. Seashells over millions of years make limestone. Limestone's used to make concrete, another very important thing in our environment. The thing is, Mother Nature has such a nice way of dissolving carbon and taking it out of the system to so it doesn't cause the problems in our environment the way it does. Because the fact that carbon is so reactive, just like you say, in so many ways, it's utilized every place in our type of system. I don't know if there's a comment there, a question there.
Sure. Yeah, it's an extremely important point, because what the caller has just described is one arc of what scientists call the carbon cycle. The global carbon cycle is the flow of this material through life, through the oceans, through the soil and rock, over time scales, depending on how you look at it, ranging from nanoseconds to hundreds of millions of years. And to bring it back to, you know, one of the most prominent discussions we're having about climate today, about carbon today in climate, is that nature has been giving us a huge subsidy in terms of our carbon pollution. It takes about an average of 57% of the carbon we put into the atmosphere every year, and it hides it in the oceans or in forests. But that subsidy is declining. So despite all of this entire world of ways of making carbon disappear into life and into the earth, we are actually tapping out that subsidy, and that means our carbon output is actually going to be hanging in the atmosphere for longer.
Another aspect of carbon that we are actually affecting and Mother Nature doesn't deal with is with pure carbon. Pure carbon, Mother Nature makes graphite, and some people might say coal, but coal actually has a lot of other compounds with it too. But Mother Nature makes graphite, but we have come around and started making some interesting carbon compounds. Because of its chemical structure, it'll make what's called buckyballs, according to Buckminster Fuller. And because of the tetrahedral way of it reacting with things, makes it extremely strong. And these buckyballs may very well cause us some problems, or may make a lot of helpful things for us too, depending upon the way we want to use their structures.
The caller is referring to one of the greatest stories in the history of 20th century science. And in the fall of 1985, a team of Rice University chemists and physicists working with a visiting scholar from the University of Sheffield, basically, they wanted to conduct an experiment. The visiting professor from Sheffield wanted to conduct an experiment to simulate what he thought were plausible conditions for the creation of carbon molecules outside the envelope of stars. And so this was like a very sort of arcane astrochemistry experiment. And they discovered an anomaly in their data. They discovered that they were basically zapping a graphite disk with a laser beam and seeing what happened, and they got this anomaly at 60 carbon atoms, and it took them a week and a half to figure out why there should be such a strange anomaly at 60 atoms. And much to their surprise and the surprise of the entire scientific community, what they had discovered were exactly what the caller is saying, these spheres of carbon. Imagine a soccer ball that's approximately, you know, one angstrom in diameter. They named this molecule Buckminster Fullerene in honor of the geodesic domes of the famous American architect and futurist. And this was really a foundational moment for what we now know of as nanotechnology. And one of the great joys I had in my research was I actually interviewed the three Nobel laureates involved in that discovery, and they've been inspirational, and it's a terrific story. There is concern, there is some concern, I think, maybe premature concern about their environmental effects, since no one's really figured out what to do with them yet. So it might be putting the cart before the horse. It's my opinion. But the caller is referencing just one of the terrific stories of 20th century science.
And there's one other thing that carbon been amazing with that deals with all of this in a lot of ways, is that rayon. Rayon was an invention that came along in, maybe about the late 1890s, something mm-hmm. through there. And that made everything from cellophane to wiener casings to nylon socks that were so big after the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'll probably ring off now. Take care.
All right. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. And again, our guest is Eric Ralston. He's author of the book, The Carbon Age. I want to talk some more about the carbon cycle because here this is very important in terms of what's happening with climate. But maybe we could take a step back and I could ask you just to talk a little bit about why we have carbon at all, where carbon comes from, where in the universe it comes from.
Carbon comes into existence in the center of stars. Not all stars. Our star is about 20% too small. But stars all work in basically the same way. And depending on their size, they can do certain things. They burn hydrogen into helium, and that's how our star works. And our star will die when it's burned just about all its hydrogen into helium. But sometimes in bigger stars, that helium will then go through what's called the triple alpha process or the saltpeter process after the Cornell scientist who discovered it. And that's where we get carbon, is three helium nuclei come together in the 100 million degree heat of the core of these stars and form carbon nuclei. And that's initially where it comes from, and as stars die and gases travel through space and become part of new stars and solar systems and planet like ours. And so there's a great quote, I think it's from the science writer and physicist, Lawrence Krauss, who said, the history of the universe is literally in the palm of your hand, and that's absolutely true, because every atom in our bodies got its start, if not in the Big Bang, forged into existence in stars somewhere along the road.
All right. Let's talk with another caller, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. The previous caller talked about the way carbon fits in so many things, and I sort of alluded to calcium and carbonate in the oceans. And what I'm trying to get at is that a lot of people point at what a small percentage carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere. It's tiny. It does react fast. But the balance is what's important, it seems to me. And there are some people that believe already that the amount of carbon dioxide in the air and the trajectory we're on, that the oceans are getting acidified. And it's not a whole lot, but it's enough to throw off a very important ecological balance. So I still run into people who should definitely know better, who still are in denial about the calamity that is possible, and that some people believe is already inevitable, actually. So I love the science talk. I love I wanted you to talk about the fine balance that.
Sure, absolutely.
Thank you.
The caller makes two important points I'd like to address.
Mm-hmm.
First is the first point about carbon dioxide being a very small component of all the carbon on Earth. You know, that's part of the motivation that got me to write this book I was already working on it by the time Al Gore's movie came out, An Inconvenient Truth, but that just gave me more fodder because I thought, we're still just talking about climate here, and the amount of carbon in the climate is what allows for conditions on Earth to allow life, but it's a tiny fraction of the story of the carbon cycle, and the oceans are an enormous part of the story of the carbon cycle, and both living things and just the interaction of air and water bring an enormous amount of atmospheric carbon into the oceans, and it can happen abiotically, which is to say without life's intervention, or it can happen with life's intervention, and the caller referred to a small change in the ocean chemistry as a result of all the carbon we're putting into the air that then falls into the sea. It's a not insignificant change we're seeing. The oceans have become about 30% more acidic in our watch, and this has enormous and and is off, you know, I'm very careful about not trying to be alarmist, because I'm professional. This is my book is based entirely on professional peer-reviewed science. But that said, it is some of the research is alarming, and it's alarming to see that so many species, particularly the coral reefs, and many of the species that really help input atmospheric carbon into the ocean, many of these critters, not even critters, just vegetative plant life in a lot of cases, are at risk. And this could be sort of a positive feedback on our carbon emissions, and could really be an impediment to the absorption of carbon by the oceans.
Mm. Well, let me ask you to talk about something else, because there really are two sort of basic ideas that run through the book. One has to do with the carbon cycle and how we have influenced that. And I want to talk some more about that. But setting that aside for a moment, the other one has to do with the relationship between carbon in the atmosphere and temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And you say that the basic idea here is that when temperature goes up, carbon goes up. And I'm reading out of the book, when temperature goes up, carbon goes up. And when temperature goes down, carbon goes down. And that's usually the way that it's been. First temperature, then carbon. However, the big thing that changed that is when industrialization came along. And so that switched. So it was the other way. It was not first temperature, then carbon. It became first carbon and then temperature. What exactly is the relationship between carbon in the atmosphere and global temperature?
It's directly correlated. And in the geological record, through ice bubbles, through other kinds of proxy evidence, scientists believe that generally temperature will change and the amount of carbon in the atmosphere will either increase or decrease depending on that temperature change. And what scares a lot of scientists, I think, is that we now know that carbon is coming first. So what that implies is that when the temperature starts to rise, as it already is, that's going to release even more carbon. And you've seen studies about the carbon bomb that hopefully will be averted. But that's what the fear is that since temperature usually leads, the fact that carbon's leading means that there could be another carbon boost on the way. Just a funny story about how that sentence you read out of the book, how that came into being is this book took a lot of work and a lot of time, and I amassed just an enormous amount of research. You should see my basement. And one night I was down there and I was just thinking, you know what, I'm just so exhausted. How would I summarize all of this in two sentences? This whole climate change situation, how would I summarize it in two sentences? And that was the first sentence, was the correlation between carbon and temperature. And the second sentence is, if you have it there,
it must be this one. The second observation that launches this work is that humans have sped up the global carbon cycle at least 100 times faster than usual, transforming the world into one that we eventually might not recognize as our own.
Yes.
Yes.
So the rate of change is what's geologically unique. Sometimes you'll hear people say, oh, human-made climate change isn't that big a deal, because there have been periods of Earth history where there's been a much bigger magnitude of carbon in the atmosphere, and that's absolutely true. However, it's immaterial. What is material here is the rate of change. The rate in the addition of carbon to the atmosphere, the rate of temperature change is happening too quickly for many animal and plant species, and probably for our own economic progress, to change quickly enough to keep up with it.
I wanted to have you talk some more about the way that carbon cycles through the environment. And I guess as a basic point, the first thing you would have to say is that the amount of carbon that we have here on the Earth, I mean, if you look at the amount of carbon that's in the water, that's in the land, that's in the atmosphere, everywhere, it's the same. It's the amount of carbon we got at the beginning that we were handed, that's all the carbon we've got. That stays, the amount of carbon stays constant. That may, perhaps the issue is, though, is where in the environment it is. Have I got that right?
That's absolutely right. Matter is conserved on Earth. There is some escape of some material, mostly the lighter elements, out through the atmosphere. And actually, every day we receive an enormous amount of stardust every day, and a lot of it contains carbon. But here's one thing that I thought a lot about, and I write about this particularly in chapter 10 of The Carbon Age, is that we think of geology as being a really long-term thing. But the fact is that our economy is wholly dependent on carbon minerals. So I wonder, in 20 or 50 years from now, what are people going to look back and say that, here was a whole civilization of people who thought geology was just something that would completely bore them out of their skulls, and yet carbon minerals were the underpinning of everything that they had. So, what's happening? Traditionally, we think of the biosphere, the world of life and soil and oceans, and that's what scientists call the short-term carbon cycle. There's also the long-term carbon cycle, which is the passage of carbon through the Earth system, but through rock. The 200 million year trip through the air, the oceans, sediment, rock, out volcanoes, back up into the atmosphere. And what we are doing, basically, is human economics and industry has collapsed that long-term carbon cycle. We have collapsed geological time onto a short-term time scale. So the notion of geological time sort of doesn't hold anymore because we have accelerated geology by gasifying carbon minerals. And having done so, we're not sure how to stop it.
Mm-hmm. And we've, just to make sure people understand, what we're talking about is we have taken oil and coal and natural gas, which has carbon embodied in it. By burning that, we've freed the carbon and put it out into an atmosphere at a rate much, that's that part of the loop. We've greatly increased the amount of carbon that's getting into the atmosphere that way through our burning of hydrocarbons, and so we've thrown the whole thing off.
We've accelerated.
Yeah.
It's events that normally take place over hundreds of thousands or millions of years in terms of geology are now occurring over years and decades.
Let me ask you, one of the things I wanted to touch on was the whole idea of carbon sequestration,
mm-hmm.
whether, in fact, we could take some of that carbon rather than releasing it into the atmosphere and finding some way that we could store it. I guess the idea is that it would be stored one way or another, be stored in the ground,
mm-hmm.
and that some people suggest that might be a way to ameliorate this release of carbons, and also would make it possible for us to use coal, which is an abundant energy source, but we have this problem with all of the things that get released when you burn the coal. And I know that,
yep.
that there has been, there have been proposals to do this. I'm not sure that there's any, this has been tested on a large scale. What does anybody think that might be the potential of doing that?
Carbon capture and storage is probably the hottest issue in policy circles right now in Washington concerning global warming. There was a major climate bill that failed on the floor of the Senate earlier this summer. So it fell off the public radar, but behind the scenes, the carbon capture and storage is just about the biggest issue. And for the reasons that you explain, is coal, burning coal accounts for more than half of U.S. electricity generation. So if we could find a way to capture the waste gas that comes out of these power plants and store them underground, well, then we can keep burning coal, and we can do so without fearing that we were making global warming worse. Here's where things stand in terms of developing that technology. Carbon capture is actually something we've been able to do for a long time, but just not at the scale we need to. In fact, anytime you open up a bottle of soda or seltzer water, the carbon dioxide gas trapped inside that soda is actually waste gas from a coal-burning power plant that has been captured and purified and distributed to bottlers around the country. So there are technologies in the wings that hopefully will reach scale and will be able to reach much more than the tiny fraction of a percent that we now capture. The trickiest part of carbon capture and storage is making sure that once we inject the carbon dioxide underground, it will stay there. And there are in Texas, there's been a project going on for several years. In Europe, there's a lot of experimentation. So that's something that probably the last scientific piece of that puzzle is to really make sure that carbon dioxide is going to stay down there, a mile or two below the surface.
Is there, even if it's a matter of somewhat wild speculation, has anybody proposed any ideas that said, well, there's something else we can do. We can pull the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and we can do something with it. But if some kind of chemical process, we can make it into something else that we can use, or we can defuse the problem of increasing concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere. Is there anything that's other than taking it and stuffing it down in the ground, as we've just talked about? Is there any other thing that's reasonable to imagine that you could do to it?
About 20% of man-made climate change is actually not due to fossil fuel burning, but to deforestation. So the most immediate answer to the question is that, well, we can avert tropical deforestation. We can plant replant our forests, and that will make a substantial dent in our effects on the climate. There's no synthetic technology, however, and that is something a lot of people are working on, particularly in the last year or two. You see algae reactors and scientists, engineers trying to harness what only life knows how to do for our own advantage. So those are the two things to watch. The main one is really averting deforestation and replanting forests, because that's, you know, what trees, wood is basically just carbon. So that's why trees are so important for the drawdown of atmospheric CO2. And there's an enormous amount of excitement for harnessing biology, but we can't do it yet.
Yeah. Oh, and I would expect, though, that at the same time, that people who are concerned about this would say that we still have to dial back our emissions, that we couldn't plant enough trees for them to soak up the amount of CO2 that we're putting into the atmosphere.
Yeah, ecosystems are tricky because you can't just plant a forest. You need more than carbon. The oxygen is there, but phosphorus and nitrogen are vital nutrients to any ecosystem. And you need to make sure that there's a flow not only of carbon, but these other necessary elements of life. And that's why you just can't you just can't create an ecosystem. It has to emerge.
Let me we have another caller here, and I guess I'd just like to introduce once more our guest, if you have just joined us. He is Eric Roston. He was a politics and business writer for Time magazine for 6 years. He also covered technology, international trade, climate, and energy issues. He's now a senior associate in the Washington, D.C. office of Duke University's Nicholas Institute for Environmental Policy Solutions. He comments often on science, technology, and economics of climate change, and he is also the author of the book, The Carbon Age, How Life's Core Element Has Become Civilization's Greatest Threat. That's the subtitle. It's published by Walker. It's his first book, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And we certainly would welcome other folks if you'd like to give us a call and join the conversation, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And we have another caller here to talk with in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Yeah, what a wonderful holistic look. Two areas in terms of energy. Hydrogen jets. I know there's research that's being done on that. And also nuclear energy. So I know in terms of nuclear, there's a thing in terms of the whole construction and the whole thing of all the carbon that you release in terms of building stuff. So what's your take on these two areas?
There's been an enormous change in the relationship within the policy community to nuclear energy. And the climate change, dealing with climate change, is an all-hands-on-deck affair. And to sustain the electricity demand that we have and that we enjoy, and with current technologies, there's no way to sustain that load without nuclear power. And you even see movement among environmental groups acknowledging this, even though the issues of security and waste are absolutely paramount in moving that conversation forward. The hydrogen conversation has slowed, I think, since its peak in 2003 or so, as it becomes clear how difficult it is to get the hydrogen, first of all, because if you're just electrolysis is an extremely energy-consuming process, so you can get the hydrogen, but it might cost you more carbon than burning gasoline. And also there's huge infrastructure developments, particularly if you're talking about hydrogen transportation, personal transportation, that we would have to rewire or repipe our entire transportation infrastructure, and that's something that no one can think about without getting a headache real quick.
Well, but you have the issue, and it's possibly being developed for planes. And when you look at the source, certainly the amount of fuel that's used, it's certainly. What else do planes run on then? This would be the issue.
Yeah, it's still the fundamental problem is still the same, and that's that you've got to get the hydrogen from somewhere. The best place to get it is from water, but again, it takes an enormous amount of energy. And the hope for hydrogen power is that we'll have renewable technologies in place, solar, whichever it is, geothermal, wind. That we'll have a constellation of technologies that will give us electricity plentiful enough to crack hydrogen out of water. But if the interest here is in slowing our emissions, then there's currently no way to get at the hydrogen without upping our consumption of fossil fuels. And aviation is a huge problem. There are some very interesting synthetic gasoline, synthetic kerosene studies, particularly on the military side. There's a breakthrough yet, but there's a lot of activity there and a lot of interesting work being done and money pouring into these studies.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thanks. So it does that was the question. I wanted to just make sure we underlined that does indeed. I'm thinking particularly of commercial aviation. Does that significantly add to the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere?
Air travel on a per capita basis, air travel is an enormous part of an individual's carbon footprint. And consequently, our air travel. When you hear the breakdown of where our carbon emissions are coming from, it's not really broken out between at least on the most general levels. Not really broken out. Airplane travel not broken out from transportation in general, which is to say mostly cars. That doesn't mean it's not an insignificant amount, but. I think there's more focus on cars because it's a bigger problem and there are more emissions that come from our automotive fleet.
We have about 10 minutes left. Again, our guest is Eric Roston. He's author of the book, The Carbon Age. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm sure that there are some people who will be uncomfortable with what you had to say about nuclear power, and because I think people who are very concerned about the issue of our dependence on hydrocarbons and would like to see us go heavily in the direction of renewables, geothermal and wind and solar and so forth. The notion that we would have no choice but to rely heavily on nuclear generation, I think, makes people real uncomfortable. Is that something that you would argue that eventually technology can at least deal with all of those things about nuclear power that make us uncomfortable? And I suppose the biggest thing, the thing that we worry most about, is what it is we do with waste that is highly radioactive and is highly radioactive for a long time.
The ideal answer is that we do not use nuclear. But practically speaking, I'm not a proponent of nuclear, but it's hard to come away from these studies and strategic plans without thinking that there's just no baseload technology that can hit the numbers. And hopefully there will be in 5 years. Hopefully there will be in 10 years. But at the moment, perhaps part of the reason that we're seeing what the nuclear industry calls a nuclear renaissance is that there's just nothing competitive that can hit our electricity numbers.
Let's talk again with another caller. We have some more people getting lined up here. Next is Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Yes. The guest, I guess, is a known expert on carbon, but I suggest that he's not an expert on nuclear power.
I would agree with that 100%.
Okay. I would suggest, I won't try to go into the arguments here because the subject is carbon rather than the nuclear power. But I would suggest both to the guest and to anyone who's concerned about these matters, Google the phrase "forget nuclear," and it will bring up a 5-page article by Amory Levins, who is an expert on these things, that makes it clear that even without regard to the problems of proliferation and waste and so forth, that nuclear is not a practical approach to these things. And that it completely fails the market test, and that other things are available that are sufficient. And our big danger is that so much capital will be devoted to nuclear power that it will crowd out the development of these other things that would themselves be adequate and much safer. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. I'm glad that the caller made that point, and I would second his recommendation that you search for Amory Levins' paper. Amory Levins, for 30 years, has been one of our most forward-thinking and creative experts on energy, and he's just a landmark, and he's actually quite entertaining, so I would follow the caller's suggestion.
All right, and again, I think the call, obviously we wanted to talk about something else here this morning, and this came up peripherally. It's something we have talked about before on the program, and I'm sure in future we will be talking about again the potential for nuclear power, the pros and cons, and I'm sure we can find some guests. Maybe even Amory would be on the program here with us. So. We'll save that for another day and go on to another caller, and that would be Champaign County, line two. Well, maybe that caller changed his mind. In any case, we have about 5 minutes or so. Time for others, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let me ask you about something else. A good deal of the problem here has to do with transportation, and with transportation that depends on liquid fuels derived from oil. And there is now a lot of effort going into looking at least at the possibility of developing alternative liquid transportation fuels, biofuels. And I'm thinking about ethanol and biodiesel and other things. And again, there's a lot of controversy about whether that is good or bad. What do you think is the potential for, or do you have some thoughts about the potential for biofuels and what sort of role that they play in this?
Well, you've 2 points, one specific and one general that I think is important. The corn ethanol conversation has simmered in Washington for years or decades, and it peaked its head up earlier this year and then was just as quickly disappeared off radar because politicians and economists saw that it's expensive, there's not a lot of energy carbon savings there, and it has an increase in food prices. We've been talking about transportation. We talked about utilities. We haven't talked about energy efficiency, though that's a very important conversation, pivotal conversation, and again, one to plug Amory Lovins again, is one that he's been out ahead of many people for a long time. This is really how I focus my mind a lot on these issues. And, you know, in 2004, there was this pivotal paper that was written by two Princeton professors, and they divided up the amount of carbon we want to stop emitting over the next 40 years. They broke up this mass into what they called stabilization wedges. So say we want to be polluting 30 gigatons less in 40 years. And so they say, well, instead of just thinking about 30 gigatons, let's think about, you know, 5 gigatons in transportation, 5 in utilities, 5 in agriculture, 5 in forestry. And it's become a very effective way of thinking about the problem and sort of assigning responsibility. Now, and this goes to the core of the carbon age and why I wrote it, and ties into another very important conversation, a national conversation, and that is the decline of science education and literacy in the U.S. And actually, there's a report that came out in February 2001 that predicted the report was about threats to national security in the 21st century. The first threat was fanatical Islamist terrorist attacks on U.S. soil, and 7 months later we had one. Everyone remembers the Hart-Rudman report for that. Nobody remembers the second biggest threat, which is a decline in science and education. So the Carbon Age is a mainstream book. I wrote it so that people would enjoy it from high school to retirement. But also, implicit in my work and implicit in my motivations was trying to get at the fact, you know, not only is this stuff really interesting and cool, but it's going to help us be positioned to decide what technologies we need in the future, whether they're biofuels or any of the other ones, and to deploy them more quickly because we have a fuller context.
We have a couple of minutes left. I have two callers. We will try to get both of them. We'll get at least one. We'll start with line one. Hello.
Yeah, this is a lot of political, so I just wondered if you followed this interminable political presidential campaign we have, and if you've listened to Obama and if you listened to McCain, and what do you think about the presidential politics of energy and how it affects the carbon prospects we have. Mm-hmm. For example, McCain, as a Republican, is drill, 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 nuclear, nuclear, nuclear. And, of course, Obama, as a Democrat, seems to be opposed to both of those, but he is in favor of something that I think reflects his Illinois roots. He's in favor of ethanol, which I disagree with wholeheartedly. How do you feel about the presidential politics of energy?
I think that Obama has a more aggressive carbon emissions reduction proposal, and we've seen McCain sort of he's made some statements that questioned whether he was in support of a mandatory carbon cap and trade system. But I would also contextualize the statement I just made in the fact that there's no policy that's been put forward anywhere in the world that satisfies or, you know, sort of approaches what scientists say is the region we need to be in. So while you can compare and should compare and contrast the presidential candidate's policies, and it's absolutely vital that they continue to talk about this issue as much as they do, it's also good to contextualize it against the science and where the scientific community says we're heading if we don't have a change in our energy infrastructure as quickly as it's possible.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll get one more call here. Also someone local, line two. Hello.
I kind of want to return to an earlier point where the author had mentioned that there's a buzz in Congress about the carbon recapture technologies, that's the big thing. But I couldn't help but notice from what he said and from what I've read about it that the word "if" is always involved. we've got a lot of technology where we already can, you know, put panels where we need them and wind, wind turbines. That already works, and we've got all of the energy focused into yet another if technology. I didn't hear any analysis about the sanity of this type of approach. Anyway, I'd like you to talk about that.
Thank you for the question. And I need to let me emphasize that these comments are my own, and because I work a little bit in this area. Carbon capture and sequestration would be enormously expensive to get off the ground, to even justify as a scientifically viable enterprise, and that's before you even get into the very complicated issues of liability. If there's a leak, who's responsible for physical damage, should there be any, who's responsible for the finances of it. So, why are we talking about carbon sequestration if it's so difficult? And it's because we are so dependent as a nation on coal. That dependence, I think, is fueling the CCS discussion because, people who want to keep the lights on, coal industry, among them, sees that the only way we can continue to have a coal industry and fight global warming is to put the emissions underground. So I think that the scale of the difficulties in trying to get CCS to work is explained by the immensity of our dependence on coal.
Yeah. I'm sorry to have to interrupt you, but I was kind of jumping in because we're really at the end of the time and we're going to have to stop.
Okay.
With the promise to people who are listening that I'm sure that many of these issues will take up again other days with other guests. But for the moment, you want to read more on this subject, you look for the book that we've been talking about. The title is The Carbon Age. It's published by Walker by our guest, Eric Roston, former science and technology writer for Time magazine. And thanks very much.
Thank you. Are any readers, any listeners with questions can go to thecarbonage.com where you can contact me with questions.
All right.
Thank you
very
much for having me on the show.
Appreciate your time.